This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I'm super excited for our guest today. We got John Benest on the show. He is the VP of product development at Zonda Urban. And Zonda Urban, of course, provides real estate industry stakeholders with tools and intelligence to make better decisions. But John used to come on the show a lot with a friend of the show, Michael Ferreira, when they were both at Urban Analytics. And of course, Michael Ferreira now is at Anthem, and John with Zonda Urban. So
yeah, well, they sold Urban Analytics to Zonda, and John stayed there. The great thing about this is the reams of data that John Benest has access to. And man, we cover the gamut today, talking all things Vancouver real estate, and so insightful. It's such an insightful conversation. I took this one on myself, Adam. You weren't there. And I just want to make a note for you. I mean, there's so many takeaways, but John's analysis of downtown Vancouver, wait for it. That's the thing that was a unique takeaway for me. And I've been thinking about it ever since. So I'll leave it there. But this is a great conversation.
And timely, because we're in a moment where downtown has some of the highest inventory levels it's had in a very long time. So, I mean, this is what's going on with downtown Vancouver.
That's part of it today.
Today, I gotta go back and listen to. I'll be listening to this one, Matt. Before we get to that, of course, we're sponsored by our team, Scalina Real Estate, and there is a trivia for the segment that remains nameless. The trivia on Vancouver real estate and the city of Vancouver. I think you have a new question.
I do have a new question. I called a bit of an audible this week. It's funny. I came up with this question earlier today. It almost feels outdated already. And when I say call a bit of an audible, I mean not about Vancouver or necessarily the province of British Columbia. But I had Trump tariffs on my mind when I came up with this one. So we'll see if you can get this one, Adam. You ready for it?
Sure.
So, of course, we know Ontario Premier Doug Ford has really taken a lot of the spotlight over the last week or two for his response to Trump's tariff and the trade war. Of course, he has added, and as we record this moments ago, rescinded a 25% tariff on electricity across three states. He removed all the booze, all the U.S. Produced booze from liquor stores in Ontario. He was on MSNBC, and this is the quiz question for you. It's a long windup. He was on MSNBC and warned Americans that removing booze from all the liquor stores would be very harmful for them because Ontario consumes more booze than what? Hold on. Ooh. Before you come up with your answer, Adam, I was going to say highlight a listing, and we can highlight a number of listings, but I feel like we've been talking about listings, and when we talk about listings, we downplay the sold plan, which is at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. So this week, I just wanted to highlight the sold plan specifically. Adam, what does the sold plan stand for?
Yeah, Matt, the sold plan stands for start on launch date. And so this is a guide, a step-by-step guide. All you have to do is pick the day that you plan to launch the listing, and it gives you step-by-step advice to get your home ready for market to achieve top dollar in the shortest amount of time. It is free. It's an instant download, and it's on our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Just click sell with us.
Sell with us at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, and it's an instant download. That's what I like. It's straight into your inbox, and that's very simple and very effective. So, Adam, okay, just to remind you, Doug Ford went on MSNBC and warned Americans that removing all the American-produced alcohol from the liquor stores will be harmful because Ontario consumes more booze than what?
So I missed this soundbite.
Yeah.
okay. Clearly. so I'm going to say Ontario consumes more. Huh. That's a tough one. This is a pretty open-ended. I mean, if you didn't see the segment.
Okay, let me walk you through it a little bit. He was basically trying to suggest that Ontarians drink a lot of booze.
Okay, I figured that much.
<It's okay. laughs> he's making a comparison to
tell me how you feel about my intellect through how you coach me through this.
Somebody or somebody else, somebody that drinks a lot of booze.
Yes. An individual.
I'll give you that much, an individual.
Okay, well now all I got to do is figure out what is it? Nick Cage and Leaving Las Vegas? Who's a good?
Is that your final answer?
I was going to say it's probably like a music person, somebody in the music world. I don't know who's a standout. I can think of like potheads.
Or Snoop maybe Dogg,
somebody like that.
Keith Richards, that type of thing.
Yeah, but drinking, like there's not, are there really too many standout drinkers when you think about, my final answer is David Hasselhoff before having a burger on the floor.
Oh, God. I remember that. Yeah, that is good.
Video.
That is good.
Video. That was a good guess, though.
That was a good guess. Not correct. Ontario consumes more booze than Stephen King did circa Cujo.
Whoa.
What a crazy reference, eh? So I did some digging after I read this.
Where did he... The thing is, where did he figure that out?
That was it. Can you imagine? Doug Ford doesn't strike me as a guy who reads a lot of Stephen King, let alone Stephen King's memoir where he details the fact that he doesn't even remember writing Cujo because he was drinking more than a case of beer every day and like mounds of cocaine, apparently.
Well, I was just thinking, Cujo, is that the one where about the Pet Cemetery? But no, that's Pet Cemetery. So
you're like, is that the one about the clown It? No.
Yeah. but no, yeah, well, that's wild. I didn't even know Stephen King.
Well, this is the thing. Was, and neither did I.
Had some substance abuse issues. That's wow.
I feel like that's a real zinger. Anyway, I wasn't expecting you to get it, but I thought I'd include it in this week's quiz.
Yeah, that's a good one to include because it has a lot of relevance to Vancouver real estate. But without further ado, why don't we cut to this conversation with John Benest?
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
Adam, we want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Soane House, one of Marcon's latest communities that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced, Nordic-inspired design for architecture that endures.
Soane House offers 165 junior 1 to 3-bedroom homes in West Coquitlam, integrating nature into the built environment.
Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's marcon.ca/soenhaus, or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
We also want to highlight 102 and Park. With billions already invested in Surrey City's central development over the last 15 years, the time is now to invest in its future, Surrey 3.0.
Introducing 102 and Park, a simple, straightforward skyscraper featuring 376 homes. Quite simply, this is a once-in-a-decade opportunity coming soon to Surrey's central downtown plaza. This is a time and the place to invest. Register at marcon.ca/102andpark. That's marcon.ca/102andpark.
Marcon, building for life.
Well,
Okay, so we're here with John Benest, Vice President, Product Development at Zonda Urban, and of course, the former principal and co-owner of Urban Analytics. How you doing, John?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks, Bab.
Yeah, you know, and we should say past guest fan favorite. You were back on the show a number of times when you were still owner of Urban Analytics. I think you might have been on once under your new title, but for listeners who aren't familiar, John, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started in the business about 20 years ago, working as a market research analyst for Polygon Homes, primarily learning about the market, figuring out what was going on, visiting sales centers, kind of getting a feel for what was going on throughout all regions of Metro Vancouver. Then went on to working for Mosaic Homes, another awesome veteran developer. Parlayed that into a career working in consulting, partnered up with Michael Ferreira at Urban Analytics. We did primarily consulting and advisory services for new home developers, and then parlayed that into a data subscription platform called NHS Live, newhomesourcelive.ca, which we grew and expanded throughout Western Canada and serviced over 1,500 industry stakeholders in Western Canada. And then subsequently, we've sold our company to Zonda Home about 3.5 years ago, and I still work for Zonda Home. We've since rebranded to Zonda Urban, and primarily as a function of our marketplace being very urban in nature in terms of the new home construction. So all of the majority of our new condos, new townhomes is the core product that we track and we monitor and provide advisory services for. So we have our own unique branding, Zonda Urban, within the Zonda Home umbrella.
And so for people who aren't familiar with Zonda Urban, can you give us an overview of what you do? Of course, you mentioned advisory services, but what is Zonda Urban all about?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, on the advisory side, our core clients would be residential housing developers. Typically, they would come to us when they're looking to acquire a property. They want to know the highest and best use of that property. They want to know what they can potentially sell a condo project for or rent a new purpose-built rental for. Ultimately, they want to have an understanding of what they can charge and what absorptions they can achieve. And they also want to know what is the optimal unit mix, suite mix, specs that they should be putting together in an overall package in order to kind of optimize success for that particular platform. So that's the advisory side. Obviously, myself, been in the business for 20 years now. We have a great team of advisory leads who can help with providing advisory recommendations. We can do that. But then we also do primary research on the new home market as well, too. So we have a team of researchers that will actively go and visit sales centers and get all the information in terms of sales, prices, everything you want to know about a project that's actively selling in the marketplace. We then take that information and put it to our database, nhslive.ca, which industry stakeholders would subscribe to when they're looking to make better decisions about their respective projects. So our business is twofold, that advisory for those developers and then tertiary stakeholders and developers who want access to the platform.
So as I feel like I've asked you before, and I've started with the same line, that there's probably nobody better to ask this, but how's the market?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a very kind of open question, which is great. I mean,
you got an hour.
Yeah, you got an hour. So just as part of the acquisition as well to Zonda Home, we do a semi-annual market update presentations. The most recent one we did in November of this year. And I was part of a group of panelists who spoke on behalf of the market, which was great to participate in that. We called the market, or coined the market, the good, the bad, and the better, with an optimistic twist at the end of it. And just first starting off actually with the bad, more so than the good. The bad is, and the new home market is, that, you know, we're just not getting the same level of buying activity that we used to in the past 4 or 5 years. So we're starting to see listings in the market increase. I think we had roughly 15,000 active listings of new home product in the market, and pair that with only 2,000 new home sales this past quarter and the previous quarter before. So we're starting to see a really big gap between active listings in the market and quarterly sales, which would likely result in something of the lines of 24 months of supply of new home construction, which is quite high. If this was the resale market, which, you know, as you know, that would be significantly favored towards buyers at that point in time. So it's definitely kind of a challenging times on the new home market.
And sorry, you say, so that those last two quarters are basically the last half of 2024 you're describing.
Exactly. Yeah. So the last half of 2024, we had just around 4,000 new home sales. You know, if you were to extrapolate that into a full year, we would have just around 8,000 to 10,000 new home sales in the market, which is probably 40 to 50% below the past 10-year averages. You know, typically we would have anywhere between 15,000 and 20,000 new home sales. In a kind of more normalized or even a more robust market, we would have north of 20,000 new home sales, you know, anywhere between 25,000 and 30,000 new home sales. So we kind of got this interesting kind of dynamic where, you know, developers are launching their respective projects, but they really want to hit either 60 or 70% pre-sale so that they can hit their pre-sale requirements. And they're kind of turning into, you know, we hit 10%, 20%, maybe even 30%. And then what do you do from there? So that's the kind of interesting situation. You know, the other kind of thing that's interesting about the market as well, too, is, you know, because we've been tracking the market and I've been in the industry for 20 years, is I kind of try and relate the times right now to what it used to be in major downturns. So if you look at, you know, the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, I was part of that at the time. I was working for developer Mosaic, and it was quite a shocking time for the industry. The market went fairly paralytic, you know, for a good 6 to 9 months. It was kind of like everyone was looking around going like, is anything going to sell ever?
is anybody ever going to buy another home?
Yeah, totally. So what the market did was that the market just shrank ultimately. And there's, you know, a lot of people fighting for, you know, for sales. And really only thing that was moving the market at the time was people who had to buy for various reasons, either for was a new kid along the way, a divorce, moving to the area and really looking to buy and settle down. It was more for personal or family reasons, but there was really not a whole lot of investment going on. It was paralytic. And then what happened was the central bank really went hard and fast on dropping interest rates, and prices were off, you know, anywhere between 15 and 20% in some areas. Oh yeah. And then further to that, you know, we had the construction industry where, you know, developers actually could, and in some cases went back to their trades and general contractors and said, hey, look, like this project right here, it's not viable. You know, would you be amenable to maybe a 15, 20% price reduction for your fees? And in some cases, they successfully renegotiated lower construction cost contracts and were able to then subsequently move their projects forward. And I also think, you know, in 2008, 2009, there was a time where you actually looked at affordability, where you had interest rates drop so significantly and then construction costs and prices then come down to match where the market was at. It reestablished and set a floor for buying activity to happen again. You saw a point where it was like, hey, it actually makes more sense to buy if I can scrounge up a down payment. It actually makes more sense to buy than it would be to rent in some cases. So it was really kind of a catalyst for springing the market back up, you know, around the 2010 Olympic timeframe is when the market really rebounded. And if you fast forward today, you know, the core kind of difference between today, it's a little bit slower and drawn out. You know, you still have a slightly higher interest rate environment, which is challenging. But I would say the biggest difference is the fact that, you know, we have not a decreasing environment for construction costs. You know, I've heard recently that construction costs have come down somewhat, but ultimately, you know, overall, we just have such a shortage of trades and people to get the job done that, you know, you have kind of a stale or increasing cost environment. So, you know, if a developer has a project that might not work, if they were to go back to their general contractor and say, hey, could you take a 10, 15, 20% reduction in your job, they would just say, no way. It's really kind of caught the development industry in an interesting time, just from a feasibility perspective. There's not as many levers to bring the price down to consumers to ultimately kickstart the market again in the short term. And that's specifically in the pre-sale development space.
I've been watching, and we've had, you know, Bo Jarvis especially, it comes to mind, but other people at West Group seem to be really aggressively trying to change the narrative around the development community, really trying to educate people on some of the layered costs, you know, the DCCs, the range
CACs.
Of CACs, yep. That's what I was looking for. All these layers of costs that most people aren't aware of. And, you know, I think when you watch all the effort that's going into that, it's like, that just makes a lot of sense. It's good practice. But it strikes me, based on what you're saying, is that might be one place where there is actually the possibility of relief, or the only place really, if you can't go back and grind on your trades or whatever you need to do.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, fees are definitely been something that's been ever escalating over the past 10 plus years. And I can't speak to why. I mean, it started, you know, the city of Vancouver was doing CACs, and it started to get to a point where, you know, in a rising market, we were at the UDI event and the panelists last week, you know, they're talking about that. They're saying, you know, as a development industry, you know, the municipalities would continue to layer on new additional things like additional costs and additional requirement or that sort of thing. And in a rising market, they were okay with it. They said, you know what, the profit margins are okay. You know, we'll take a little bit of a hit here. We'll continue on and we'll continue to build. But it does start to get sticky in a situation where, you know, the margins start to get thinner and thinner. And you get go to yourself, if you're a developer, like, what am I doing? There's a lot of risk here, but, you know, for what reward? So that's kind of a scenario where, you know, if you have an ever-increasing cost environment, even on the municipal side, that's where it does start to get really challenging. And, you know, it's good that, you know, groups like West Group are, you know, starting to open up the discussion around that for sure. Because the bottom line is on the new home side, you know, a lot of these projects based on the cost structure are not feasible. You know, I was talking to an industry colleague about a year or two ago, you know, even just chatting about Langley, and, you know, we're talking about, you know, how Langley now is having high rise construction in certain areas. There's two high rise in North Langley that, you know, I've never seen a high rise in that location before. There's going to be a lot in Langley City when the SkyTrain extension goes there. And, you know, he was saying to me, you know, just if you even have free dirt to build something, you know, you'd have to sell those condos for brand new for minimum $800 a foot. You can't sell it for any lower because the costs are so high to build. That's just what the new costs are.
Staying on the bad here for a minute, 2,000 sales, 15,000 listings. You're right, on the resale, that would lead to falling prices. But what I'm hearing here is in 2008, there was conditions that allowed for prices to come off to generate absorption. And the challenge right now is that there's no give in the current pricing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we also track construction activity as part of where they're at in the construction status. So we'll track, you know, all the projects in the market that are either, you know, haven't started construction yet, pre-construction, and then we'll track them once they start excavating, building parkade, framing, all the way into completion. So that's kind of a more interesting part of the analysis that we can do is take a look at, okay, what are projects that are actively selling in the market? You know, so we already noted that there's probably 15,000 actively selling units in the market throughout all stages of construction. And what is kind of interesting is that, you know, we have an environment where I think roughly half of those units are located in projects that have yet to begin construction. And within those units, those projects have yet to sell 35% of their respective project inventory. So what that means is they haven't necessarily hit their financing threshold to get construction financing. So what that may result in is a lot of these projects, you know, even half the inventory in the new home market could potentially be pulled off within the next 1 to 2 years. So that's something we're definitely looking at right now is how much of this pre-sale inventory is actually going to come to fruition in terms of completed inventory. So we're estimating that, you know, if the market doesn't pick up, you know, we could have a balance in check in terms of oversupply. There could be half of that inventory just being pulled from the market, essentially, which would then kind of put a floor to pricing. Where there are opportunities is in projects where they're already under construction and, you know, they have no choice but to kind of complete that construction. So we also track that as well too. So we track, you know, units in condo projects specifically that are under construction or are complete. And that number is starting to rise. So we have, you know, as of the last update, we checked almost 2,000 units of new standing inventory. So we define standing inventory as completed and unsold inventory in the market. And that's significantly higher than what we've seen over the past 10 to 20 years. And we have a potential 2,600 further units that could be completing that are unsold in the next year. So, you know, you look at it from a developer's perspective, but I also like to look at it from a buyer's perspective. I think if there are opportunities in the marketplace, and if you are an end user and you are looking to get into the market and you want brand new and you don't want something that's older, that could be an arena where you could start to kind of play ball and look for some good opportunities relative to what prices were at the peak of the market on the pre-sale front, you know, the past 2 or 3 years. And the markets where we're seeing a lot of standing inventory or future inventory in the condo side are specifically Burnaby and Richmond are the two primary locations. And then sprinkles of potential inventory in the Tri-Cities, Vancouver West Side and the Vancouver East Side.
Man, I feel like we should have saved that for the end. That was okay. That was fantastic. So there's kind of two things I was hoping to unpack there. One is obviously that the opportunities there. You know, we were talking to somebody late last year, a Surrey builder, who was saying, you know, the real challenge is those last remaining units. Like, to get them sold right now is nearly impossible. And he was saying that's what he would be targeting. It sounds like you're in agreement, not even necessarily built. As long as it's in the process of being built, there's some motivated sellers out there.
Yeah, for sure. And even speaking with you earlier about it, you know, it's definitely an end user market right now. We're not seeing as much investment activity for a variety of reasons. You know, I was just read an article recently with Ryan Berlin at Rennie, and he was saying, you know, within the projects that they track, it went from 50% investors down to a quarter of their projects that they're selling are investors. So it's really, really an end user driven market. And so we're hearing, you know, people are buying for, you know, personal reasons. Again, that's very similar to 2008, 2009. It's, I want to get into the market. You know, I want to grow into a larger unit, or if it's a parent looking to get the kids into the market. So there is still activity happening. There's activity happening on the townhome side in terms of sales activity. There's activity happening in the low rise condo side of the market. So that's kind of where, you know, we do see bright spots in the market. And we call it, you know, in the previous presentation that was done at the end of 2024, is the Goldilocks zone of development opportunities. And the Goldilocks zone is, you know, what we defined as where there were projects in the market that were seeing success. So a lot of these projects had the same characteristics, under 200 units. Big reason is because if you want to, you know, get your financing approved, you typically need to get 50 to 60% pre-sold. So if you have a smaller project, it's a lot easier to break the back of a 100 unit project if you get 60 sales versus a 400 to 500 unit project where you need to hit 300 sales. So that right off the bat is helpful. Obviously creating urgency, you know, a smaller boutique project is going to be more, you know, have that sense of urgency relative to a larger project. Timelines as well too. So, you know, high rise projects that are 40, 60 stories, those projects could take, you know, anywhere between 5 to 8 years. And end users, you know, for the most part, they typically want to have, you know, a 2 to 4 year time horizon before they move in. I don't think, you know, unless it's a parent buying for a kid, a lot of like things happen in, you know, 7 to 8 years. You know, I had a friend one time who bought into the independent building, you know, and he bought a one bedroom unit and then pre-sale and then got married, had a kid. And then like,
yeah, he needed, you know, he needed a three bedroom by the time it was complete.
I needed a three bedroom. And I guess if he had to sell it, he may be considered a speculator, but I don't think he's a speculator at all. He's just a regular person who bought into a pre-sale that had a 7 to 8 year time frame of completion. So that's one. Low rise projects under 200 units, you know, they're typically, you know, 2 to 4 years to build. So it's more appealing for that end user, more affordable to build. So it allows that project to respectively bring the price point down, which is more in line with what the buyers are looking for today. The majority of the projects that have performed well over the past 6 months are in that Goldilocks zone. They're primarily south of the Fraser. So locations like, there was a couple in Coquitlam, but the majority were in Surrey City Center, Surrey, South Surrey, Langley, Abbotsford. There was one in Squamish. All low-rise projects under 200 units. Majority of them are priced below 1,000 a foot. So some are in the kind of 800 to 900 a foot price per square foot range. That's really what's been driving the market. So if we kind of compared all different product forms, concrete condos, wood frame condos, townhomes, you know, in previous years, concrete condos would kind of take the lion's share of new home sales across the region. And right now it's, you know, wood frame condos are neck and neck with concrete condos, if not higher than concrete condos right now. So as we look to the first quarter of 2025, a lot of the projects that are coming ahead in the market, those are the types of projects that we're seeing. So our team, you know, every time we look at all the upcoming launches for new condo projects, the majority of them are in that zone as well too. We have a lot of Langley condo projects that are coming to market, Coquitlam, Abbotsford as well too. So yeah, it's crazy. I never would have thought that, like, you know, getting started a long, long time ago that Abbotsford would be the hot market in Metro Vancouver, but here we are.
Yeah, you and me both. What about property, not necessarily property types, I guess, but clearly townhomes, I think, would be performing better than, say, concrete studios right now. But is there a move? Have you witnessed any sort of patterns in terms of either buyers shying away from the smaller units because it's an end user market? And is that translating into the types of floor plans that developers are putting forward in new projects?
Yeah, I mean, just speaking purely on the pre-sale side, I still think that studio units are performing fairly well, just from the perspective that the sentiment in the market is just, for those who are looking to buy real estate, they're just trying to get in and they're trying to figure out, like, what can it work within, what price points I'm allowed to get approved for and that sort of thing. So I don't think it would necessarily has resulted in, you know, any type of extreme shift in units being offered. I think we're still seeing studio units, but as you do go further out in the suburban areas, I think there is that expectation that you're, if you are going to move out, you are going to get a little bit larger of a unit than you would alternatively in a market like Vancouver. So for that reason, you know, people are still looking into one and two bedrooms. But yeah, I mean, a market like Langley, you know, we're just chatting with our team the other day, and there is a couple of projects have done, you know, decently well. And, you know, typically you do get buyers who are local buyers in and around that area. So if you're a Langley project, you're typically going to attract people from Langley, Cloverdale, Surrey, you know, but this one was interesting. They did get some people from the Tri-Cities. And again, it's just people moving out into a different location with a more affordable price point, looking to get a little bit more space. So it's not necessarily the units that are changing. We're potentially starting to see a little bit of a migration pattern where people say, you know what, I will change the location of where I live to get the unit that I want at a specific price point.
It's still kind of the chasing affordability in a lot of ways is the pattern in a presale market.
Yeah. And I was chatting with, you know, another industry friend of mine, Ted Dawson at Dawson and Sawyer, and they're very much focused on, you know, Surrey is a very prime location for them in terms of where they do their core business. They have a lot of business in the Fleetwood area, the Newton area, and they've done business in South Surrey as well too. So they're kind of the Surrey experts. And so we're, you know, chatting about that. And I just remember the days when we would, you know, we would take a look at an area like Newton or Guildford or Surrey City Centre or different pockets and neighborhoods in Surrey. And you would kind of even make the argument, well, this location probably commands a 5% premium over that location. And you could really crunch the numbers and you could do the analysis on those neighborhoods and you could really kind of geek out on that. Now it's kind of shifted. There's not as much of an emphasis on locational premiums. It's really a function of, you know, what is the unit type? What is the developer offering in terms of price per square foot? So, you know, it's funny if you were to kind of even look at a neighborhood like Newton, it's not necessarily getting any discount, which it might have gotten 15, 20 years from now relative to, you know, a neighborhood like Fleetwood or even Guildford. So it's been quite fascinating. Another part, just going back to the kind of projects in the Goldilocks zone, a lot of them are not even located in great spots in terms of adjacencies. Some are maybe located in more industrial settings, or some are located on busy streets that have, you know, lots of car frontage. So it's really, really price sensitive, this market. People are really looking at what is the price.
The strange thing, and I'm kind of just thinking out loud here, is like how to square the extreme price sensitivity with the fact that those, you know, you're talking about Surrey specifically, that the prices, there's not the variance that there was, but that's almost, that's a region-wide phenomenon as well, right? To some extent, like, I feel like the last, since COVID, we've kind of been talking in and around the, do Surrey prices make sense in relation to, you know, somewhere closer to Vancouver, and those, yeah. the clear, like, this is the percentage between these two markets has kind of disappeared. But it's interesting that, you know, those two things are working together, that there's like a flattening of pricing and also this price sensitivity out there.
Totally. And it's also, you know, a lot of developments are kind of offering things from a cost up perspective, you know, again, going back to the construction costs, land costs, holding costs. A lot of developers, you know, over the past couple of years, you know, they'd already have their costs baked in previous years, and they'd say, okay, what is the market telling me? Oh, could I get $100 a foot more? Maybe I can get $200 a foot more. Now it's more like, this is what my costs are. Here's what I need to sell this at in order to make the numbers work. So regardless of whatever the market's telling me, this is what we're going to price it at, and let's see how it goes. So kind of different. It's kind of reverse engineering of the kind of methodology behind trying to price projects out, which has been kind of an interesting shift. So that's been one observation, but definitely, yeah, to your point, the flattening of pricing has been pretty amazing over the past 5 years.
Just going back to something I think we haven't talked on the show much about, in terms of the number of projects that are, you know, somewhere in that terrible zone of like, we're 30% sold or 25% sold and kind of sitting, can we flesh out what that looks like for listeners that are like, so what, it takes longer to sell? How does that all play out if they just don't hit those financing goals? You know, what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, for people who, like, in the development community who have been working on these projects, are typically aware of this, but for those who are, you know, kind of more familiar with more resale real estate, usually for a new condo project, let's say, for example, it's 100 units. Usually what a developer would do is it would put a marketing name for the project. It would put the website together. It would start to generate interest and build a leads list. And they would try and get as much interest in that project as possible. And then they would have an official launch date of that project. And that at that point, you know, buyers could get access to units within that project for the first time. And typically, you know, over the past, you know, 20 years since I've been, you know, analyzing it, usually the majority of the sales of these specifically high-rise projects, they typically happen within the first 3 to 6 months of launching. And so it's a very critical period of the pre-sale campaign. Usually what happens is, you know, in previous years, you would have that 100-unit project and they would sell 60 units within, you know, 3 to 6 months. And then after that 6 months has gone on, they would go into tempo mode, you know, where a lot of the investors who are kind of, you know, the people who are at the very front end of this looking for the best value in the building, they would like to buy as early as possible and get the best selection possible. Well, that selection's now kind of taken out of the building and you have the remaining 40 units of that building. So it would then go into tempo mode where your absorptions would typically drop off substantially all the way until the project was complete. So, you know, in the past, that's kind of how it would work. And what's really important, again, about the 60% is that you get your construction financing, you get going on the construction of that project, and you can get going on closing those units when that building's complete. So if you haven't hit your 60% in a year of selling it, the odds of you, every month that goes on after the 6 month timeframe, of you then selling faster and faster and more units relative to the first 6 months goes exponentially down. So realistically, if you haven't been able to do it, sell 20% or more of your units in the first 6 months of launching, the market is telling you that it is not necessarily interested in your project for that price and at that time and that location. So ultimately, sorry, just wrap that thought up. So ultimately what it's saying is there's not a good likelihood that it's going to actually sell. And further to that, the REDMA rules require that for a contract, you know, you need to begin construction on that project 12 months after that contract, or else you can't go ahead and you have to go back to your buyers and say, hey, look, would you like to extend the completion time of this contract or would you like to walk away? That kind of thing. So we do have a lot of projects where, say, you get into the 40 to 50% zone, then you're like, okay, let's make this work. Let's hit that mark. And there's some in there that are in the market where they're saying, okay, let's try and get that extra 10%. And they're working really hard to get those buyers to get to that 60% mark. They're offering incentives. They're lowering their deposit structures. They are doing draws. They're offering, you know, very kind of lucrative realtor commissions. And they're doing what they can within the budget that they have to get to that 60% mark. And they're also going back to their existing buyers and saying, hey, we're almost there. Can you then further on your contract to extend to a longer completion timeline? But those at the 20% mark, you just got to wonder, is it worth it?
Yeah.
If you've been on the market for that long, is it worth it? So, you know, in that case, you know, are likely to go back to the table and say, well, if we have deep pockets, we may hold, just wait on this site and wait for, you know, more favorable market conditions. We could potentially pivot and do a rental building. And that's just something on our advisory side. Our team, you know, the majority of requests for advisory work is now on the rental side. Just because of this pivot to rental construction, see, financing has been a great help for encouraging rental construction. I believe that program has ended, which is making it less feasible on that front. But up to that point, yeah, it's been super helpful. And we've had a lot of our clients, you know, have previously only done for sale condominium product, are now looking at incorporating rental as part of their portfolio. It's kind of like a thing you need to have now being a developer here in Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, diversifying, I guess.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible. This podcast is sponsored by Fenway by Caliber, bringing 209 new homes and 24,000 square feet of retail space to Willoughby Town Center.
And this retail component isn't just adding to the area, Adam. It's enhancing an already thriving community hub where neighbors connect over boutique shopping, great food, and everyday essentials. This is one of the final new construction opportunities to own in the heart of Langley's Willoughby Town Center.
And speaking of Langley, is it me or is Langley all you hear about these days? It's become such a powerhouse with over 7,000 businesses, the population set to double by 2040, and that SkyTrain extension arriving in 2029.
What's incredible about this location is that you're getting the best of everything. Your steps from the Langley Event Center, currently undergoing a massive $149 million expansion. The new tennis center and future Willoughby Community Center are right across the street. Plus, you've got the new Smith Athletic Park just down the road.
The location really is unbeatable, with 8 schools within walking distance and just minutes from Highway 1. And what I love is that this is a caliber project. They're Langley locals with decades of experience who really understand this community. They've partnered with Polyco Group to bring decades of development expertise to Fenway.
With Langley's population set to double and transit connectivity expanding, this is your chance to be part of BC's fastest growing community. Register at fenwayliving.com. That's FENWAY living.com.
Fenway, where small town heart meets urban sophistication.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
And for those listening who, you know, are not in the industry, or, you know, or God forbid, bought a presale contract somewhere where it's at 20%. I guess going back to your original point of the inventory levels are X, but if a lot of these projects disappear, you know, we're in a different situation. Can we spell out, like, what does that look like when a developer pulls the plug? And if there's a number of developers that decide to pull the plug on these already launched presale projects where there's not shovels in the ground?
Yeah. So from the buyer's perspective, and I guess I'm speaking a little bit beyond my expertise, but I can kind of paint a picture as to how it might look. I analyze the market, but I'm not a lawyer. You definitely want to bring a lawyer for that.
Well, you're sure.
But I would imagine, and I hope I don't get hate on for this, but I would imagine, you know, you basically, what would happen is a developer would send a letter to those who bought into those projects. And they would say, you know, unfortunately, you know, we didn't get the sufficient pre-sales. You know, here is your deposit back. Thank you very much. And so you get your deposit back, that sort of thing. And in some cases, it could be a good thing, because maybe you bought into a pre-sale that was price X, and now the market is now price Y, which is lower than price X. So in some cases, it could be a relief to those buyers that you're not losing any money. So it could be a good thing. Could be frustrating for somebody. You know, we had the reverse of that in a rising market, where developers had to, for whatever reasons, their costs were too high, they couldn't perform on their projects, go back to their buyers and say, hey, look, we can't perform on this. You know, that's actually probably one of the worst scenarios for buyers, when the market has gone up substantially. I know there was one project in Richmond, Atmosphere, where, you know, a lot of buyers bought into it at very good prices, and the market has since gone up. And, you know, the developer was unfortunately unable to perform based on a revised cost structure that came in. So, you know, the buyers were kind of, unfortunately, didn't get to participate in the appreciation of that pre-sale purchase. So if anything, like, I would hope to think that the buyers who bought into projects where prices have potentially come down a little bit might be happy with that. But everyone's different.
Sure.
In terms of the market, you know, it's kind of like a stopgap for making sure that prices don't fall too far. You know, if we had an environment where we had to build everything out, we would see a massive oversupply. But as a function of the fact that we have to get, you know, sufficient pre-sale contracts in place in order to build, it's kind of like a check and balance for making sure we don't oversupply. So if that were to happen, you know, that would probably result in, instead of 15,000, you know, to 17,000 vacant and unsold units in the market, we would have, you know, a maximum worst case scenario of 7,000 to 8,000, which is not great, but is a lot better than 15,000 to 17,000. So if anything, it just kind of, again, kind of puts the floor in the market. So for those who are looking to potentially get into the market and want to buy something new, brand new, the best opportunity is likely within the next year or 18 months.
Okay, because I was just going to say, that was my next question. How long does this last? And what does it take? Because, like, we're starting, you know, I'm just starting to see this might not go out for a couple of weeks, John. And in that case, you know, Donald Trump's in the White House. We don't know what's coming, or it might be a very different situation. But I'm starting to see mortgage rates that are under 4. There's some attractive things on the personal financing side, or financing to buy a place side. Like, how long does this last, and what does it take to get this moving?
Yeah, the whole tariff thing is super confusing. Like, we have a tariff and then we don't, and then we have a tariff. So And now we do again. So I don't, yeah, it's super complex environment. I think just generally speaking, you know, that type of geopolitical environment kind of lends itself to a more cautious outlook. So, you know, the bad news with that is, you know, I think people maybe who were interested in buying in January and then all of a sudden this news came out, you know, maybe decided to punt that out to February, March, or even April, you know, because they don't know if that impacts their own careers or their industries that they're in or that kind of thing. So I think there's definitely going to be a layer of uncertainty around that. But ultimately, you know, I think we're kind of getting there, you know, going back to the 2008, 2009, you know, looking at 2010 when the market rebounded, the biggest catalyst to the market was just people crunch the numbers on their own time and they go, hey, you know what? Like the interest rates are down, the prices are down. This makes more sense on a monthly basis if I can scrum up a down payment to buy and my monthly mortgage payments are lower than I am to rent. And I think we're actually, you know, as it relates to now, fast forward to 2025, we're almost getting there. You know, we had a recent interest rate reduction. And to your point of, you know, commercial lending rates are now going down. I think if we get, you know, another 25 to 50 basis points, we're almost, if not in that zone of where you actually look at where mortgage rates are in certain situations and go, you know, it's not that much different. If not, you know, if I can find a significant down payment that, you know, they're the same or lower than certain rental situations. And we have the benefit of tracking the new rental market, new purpose-built rentals, in addition to the new for sale market. So we start, you know, we could do that analysis as well too. So we'll take a look at, you know, let's just say we'll take a look at four core active markets in Metro Vancouver, Tri-Cities, Burnaby, Surrey City Centre, and, you know, Richmond. And we take a look at like for like product. We'll take a look at new purpose-built rental that's concrete in each of those markets. We can take a look at the average rents for those purpose-built rentals and contrast that with the average price concrete condo in those areas. And with interest rates that we had a year ago, it was, you know, clearly more beneficial to rent than it would be to own. And then you fast forward today with the most recent interest rate drops, we're now in that zone where, you know, we're ready to play ball. So when it comes to when is it going to happen, I actually think it could be sooner than later. And I think that's kind of one of my more optimistic sentiments of the market. If we have an interest rate drop of 1%, we're there. The market's back, I think it's back up and running in a good way.
And I guess the other thing that, you know, just thinking of that CMHC financing on the purpose-built rental side, like that presumably makes purpose-built rental less attractive. Like, is there a world in which we go back to primarily condo sales sooner than later?
In terms of, you know, what we're building?
Yeah. Like going back to the, you know, kind of the way it was, that everybody, how everybody remembers it.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to say. Like, I do think that, you know, and I try not to get political with opinions on the matter, but I do think that, like, we want to start off with creating an environment where we're encouraged to invest in real estate on a local level, like mom and pop investors. I feel like right now, you know, investor is a dirty word in the real estate space. And, you know, you talk to your friends at a party or that sort of thing. You're not as proud necessarily to tell them, hey, I invested in condo X or condo Y than maybe it was 10 to 15 years ago. So I think there's a lot of benefits to investing locally and investing in your own community because, you know, capital, if it's not invested in your own community, which local investors are doing, it's going to go elsewhere. You know, it's going to go to Alberta. It's going to go to American equities. It's going to go to the US. It's going to go to locations where capital is loved, appreciated, and accepted. And if we, you know, as a community, you'll have the narrative that investing in real estate is bad, then capital will find a home elsewhere. So I think that's kind of the start of the discussion, is like not just, you know, saying that investing is bad, because it does support our local economy and it does support the creation of our homes and it's keeping our money local. So, you know, you talk about like other industries like grocery stores and you hear about, you know, farmers markets and buying locally and that kind of thing. Well, you can even make that parallel today with, you know, people who are investing in projects across Metro Vancouver. If you're buying into Metro Vancouver, you're helping the creation of that home because you need to get to that 60% threshold. If we were to see a scenario which, you know, it's headed towards is more purpose-built rental, well, essentially, you know, it requires a lot of capital to build that. And ultimately, it relies on the big players to do that. the big REITs, institutions, your Brookfields. So a lot of that, you know, capital and wealth creation, it goes to these big REITs. You know, it's not the mom and pop. So there's got to be some type of potential reframing of the narrative to get the ball rolling if we want to get it back even closer to way it potentially was. But if we don't have that, I don't think we'll get there.
I haven't ever thought of this, but, you know, everybody's passing around the buy Canadian, you know, French's mustard or whatever. I wonder if in the future there'll be a list of Canadian developers to buy.
Yeah, that would be great.
Shifting gears a little bit, I know offline, John, you were saying one of the shifts from working from Urban Analytics that was, you know, expanding into across Western Canada, but, you know, Zonda is across North America, or Zonda Urban is. Your perspective has kind of shifted. Can we talk about other markets in Canada and the, you know, compare and contrast with what's going on in Vancouver? Like, I guess maybe I'll frame it this way. You know, looking at major metros, how unique is Vancouver's situation?
The benefit of, you know, being a part of a larger entity, you know, we have the capacity and horsepower to expand our presence throughout, you know, all of Canada. That's been one of the biggest things that we've done over the past 3 years is, since being acquired, has expanded, grown an amazing team out in Ontario. So we track the Toronto and Ottawa markets. We track Montreal. And then we went into secondary, we call them tier two and tier three markets across Canada. So population centers that have, you know, 200 to 700,000 people. We're going to track, you know, all the housing information on the new home front. We also do track Victoria, Nanaimo, Kelowna as well too, even though they're Kelowna and Nanaimo are sub 300,000 people, just very relevant to our local stakeholders. But yeah, I mean, the benefit of kind of getting access to all that information across Canada, it does allow us to get a kind of unique perspective as to what we're experiencing here in Vancouver. And, you know, going back to the Goldilocks, I think that's kind of one of our, you know, saving graces here that's kind of helped us move the market along relative to larger markets like Toronto. So like, that's kind of one of the big differences that I noticed was Ontario, they have not a whole lot of wood frame construction. It's primarily concrete construction. And the majority of their new home construction is also in the form of mega projects. So 300 unit, 500 unit, 600 unit projects. And that heavily relies on the investor buyer in order to get that pre-sale financing. So when that segment of the market dries up, they're really in a tough spot. So our market, you know, relative to Toronto has actually held up modestly well, just because we have a variety of housing options. You know, it's interesting. One of the more hotter markets in Eastern Canada is Ottawa's suburban townhouse market. So you never would have been able to kind of access that type of information kind of without kind of having access to that market. So that's one thing. And then Calgary, Edmonton are also two markets where sales activity is still very strong and largely a function of affordability in those markets. You know, climbing the housing ladder in those markets is significantly easier than it is in Metro Vancouver. And, you know, myself, you know, in the market where, you know, you can start off in a new condo and then you move up to a townhome. And then if you, you know, want more space, then you can sell your townhome and potentially move into a single family home. That's becoming more difficult. You know, I think entry level condos, once they were in the 300 to 500K range, a lot more people could get into that market. Now with, you know, one bedroom condos in the 500 to 700K range, like they are in Metro Vancouver and Toronto, you're going to need that assistance from, you know, the form of a down payment help or that sort of thing to get your foot started in the housing ladder and climb up. Calgary and Edmonton are not like that. You can kind of get your way midway up the ladder at a similar price point. So we had a colleague of ours who lives in Calgary who just recently bought, him and his girlfriend just bought his first purchase. So they're getting themselves into the housing market. But three bedroom townhome, renoed, 30 years old, 1,600 square feet, and they got it for $495,000. So that would kind of be the equivalent of, you know, your studio or one bedroom right in Vancouver. So in those markets, I think it's for people who want to skip their way up the housing market. It's been really the appealing feature for the growth and kind of intra-provincial migration to those markets. And Toronto and Vancouver are the most expensive markets in Canada. So,
you know, knowing what you know, maybe I'll put this in two ways. One is, you know, we always have the John, you got a niece who's asking you for investment advice. And we've shifted it a bit because She doesn't want to tell anyone she's investing in real estate. She's going to buy for herself, but she wants to see a decent return. So where and what would you tell her is the opportunity right now with, like, say, a 10-year timeline? And likewise, looking across the country, if she was saying, I'm open to go anywhere in Canada with your proprietary data, where would you tell her to go? And what would you tell her to buy?
And do you have any budget, unlimited budget, or?
I you know what, for this, let's say $2 million, let's just say.
$2 million. Okay. So you can buy a lot of things with that, which is great.
She's your wealthy niece.
Yeah. So, you know, when it comes to, like, let's starting with Metro Vancouver, you know, I think in previous episodes, I think there was a lot more focus on which areas were growth areas, which areas where we would see most appreciation. And, you know, I found myself that, you know, just looking at all the areas, I think there was a big shift from, you know, top end markets to a more affordable markets, and that truncation of prices, which I think has now kind of resulted in, you know, an accurate pricing across all markets right now. So I don't see, like, a necessary misallocation of pricing or, like, areas where one area is going to grow more than another. But I would say, like, in my success in previous situations of investing real estate in Metro Vancouver, it's really just trying to uncover every single rock possible to see where, hey, look, this unit here is 100K price below what the market is for that particular unit. And so that's kind of what we would do in the database. We even had market research analysts who worked for us in the past would also have the benefit of participating in that, where they knew, let's say, for example, a 2-bedroom in Langley was selling for 600K at the time. We'd know that because we would go and we'd find out all those prices. And then a new project would come to market at $400,000. So you're literally potentially buying something at 100 to 150K south of what the market is selling for. So that's kind of where we could leverage the data that we had to make kind of sound investment decisions. It wasn't necessarily a function of what markets were appreciating more. It's like, where are the mispriced opportunities in the market?
Right.
So I've been able to do that myself. There are few locations in East Vancouver where I found, you know, the prices offered for certain projects were significantly below what the market was actually bearing at the time. So, you know, I think that's kind of an idea for product. You know, if you go to a car website, like a used car website, you have all the prices and you say, like, this one's a good deal. You know what I mean? Like, you can buy into that. Like, that's what you should do. So, you know, I think that, you know, that could be a future of real estate investing, is taking a look at, hey, where are the good deals, like, relative to what's currently selling in the market?
So find an area that you're interested in. And instead of looking for, this is the up and coming neighborhood, you're looking in the neighborhood you're interested in and looking for mispriced product.
Exactly. In terms of pre-sale product, and you're looking to move into something that right away versus something that is completing in the next 4 to 6 years, the two markets that are seeing the most amount of standing inventory are Burnaby and Richmond. So if you so happen to like those neighborhoods, Brentwood, Metrotown, there may be some standing inventory opportunities in the next year that you could potentially look at. And I think prices for those standing inventory units will be quite attractive relative to the top of the market. I know in Brentwood, the top of the market was about two and a half years ago when, you know, developers were trying to achieve, you know, $1,200 to $1,400 a foot at the peak of the market for their respective projects. And, you know, there's some standing inventory projects where you could potentially get, you know, units at 1,000 a foot, maybe even less potentially. So you're getting, you know, quite a discount from the top of the market. So I would start looking there. And then, yeah, when it comes to Canada-wide, if there's any opportunities, yeah, it's tough to say because, you know, things are priced for a reason. So Calgary is, you know, lower in price than Vancouver, but what is it, -5 today here in Vancouver? I think it's -30 in Calgary. So as long as you're willing to put up with that freezing weather out there, and you do have, you know, getting into real estate as a core priority of yours, then, you know, absolutely consider it.
What about those mega projects in Toronto?
Yeah. So in terms of opportunity, for me, it's tough to say. I'm not as much of a local expert on Toronto. You know, what was happening over the past couple of years is that, you know, the investment community was doing very well in terms of the appreciation of their respective projects. So, you know, we're kind of getting in a situation where, you know, similar to downtown Vancouver as well, too, where we kind of hit a top of the market in terms of what, you know, what the end user was willing to pay for a particular unit. And people are paying pre-sale prices significantly above what resale product was trading for that was newer. So right now it's kind of a challenging process for these mega projects in Toronto, where you have upcoming levels of standing inventory. And I'm just going to throw out an example. This may not be the exact price, but you know, they maybe bought at $1,800 a foot in prime Toronto location, but you know, the market is really saying, well, we would pay $1,500 a foot for that respective location for completed inventory. So there's a lot of people that are underwater in that market who bought pre-sale. You know, I wouldn't feel too bad because a lot of those people made tons of money over the past 10 years buying pre-sale in Toronto and made a lot of money on that front. So there is a lot of risk that goes with that. But I do think there's opportunities for people who are looking to offload those properties that are closing, but don't expect it to be super cheap. It's going to be still fairly expensive, north of $1,500 a foot.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there, John. We do have this segment called the Five Wire, five lighthearted questions to end the show. They're increasingly less lighthearted lately, but we're working on them. You have time for that?
Yeah, absolutely.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark.
Okay, the first question, what's a restaurant in Metro Vancouver that you think more people should know about?
Yeah, so I'm in from Ladner. I'll give a shout out to a Ladner restaurant, a new Thai restaurant that's been around for 1 to 2 years, Soi Ram. It's a nice little kind of hole in the wall location, but delicious Thai food.
You know what? I don't think we've ever had anyone do a Ladner, the Ladner edition. I like that.
Yeah, awesome.
One book all of our listeners should read.
Yeah. So yeah, I read a lot commuting back and forth. So I don't read, I guess I listen to audiobooks. The one that I've been listening to lately is a book called Buy Back Your Time by a Canadian entrepreneur, Dan Martel. So his book is kind of around the core idea that, you know, he got into being an entrepreneur, started to get into a situation where, you know, he was having problems in his personal life because he couldn't manage, you know, he was too much into getting stuff done, working too much. And it really kind of had impact on his personal life. So, you know, he set about a strategy as to how you could, you know, essentially buy back your time. So kind of figuring out ways to, you know, pay for things that maybe you don't need to be doing, or, you know, hacks to your calendar as to how you can maximize your productivity. So for those people who are in management positions or entrepreneurial, I definitely recommend that book.
Buy back your time. That's a good one.
Yeah.
What is a strong opinion you held 5 years ago that has completely changed today? I was going to say, let's make it about real estate, but maybe that's less interesting. What is a strong opinion you held 5 years ago that has completely changed today?
Okay. Well, real estate related, I never would have thought that prices in Surrey would be so close to downtown Vancouver.
Right. I feel like if you're going 20, I was just thinking as you were coming up with real estate, I never would have said that prices downtown 5 years ago would be basically very similar to what they are today. Year over year, keep talking about the deal that is downtown, and it just, the realization doesn't seem to materialize.
My take on that is that the true value of real estate is dependent on who your prospective buyer is. So I think if you looked at downtown Vancouver real estate from a global context, and if you had full optionality as a potential buyer of downtown real estate, so if you didn't have a foreign buyer's tax, if you didn't have a vacant home tax, if you didn't have all of the taxes that were kind of layered on, I think that you would have a different type of buyer and clientele that would unlock a massively higher price point in downtown. So, you know, we had projects like the Butterfly that were $2,600 a foot. Largely, a lot of them, from what we were told anecdotally, were foreign buyers. You know, I think, again, I think a market, if you unlocked all that optionality to that real estate, would be north of $3,000 a foot. You know, that was one of the benefits of going down to the US, is that we went down to Zonda has an events company that put on an event called Elevate, second year in a row, down in Miami Beach. And some of the market.
Man, that's
pretty.
That's one of the benefits of moving on, of selling urban analytics.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. So Elevate. Yeah. So their condo market's super interesting because, you know, they do attract a lot of foreign investment. So they have, you know, buyers from South America, you know, Middle East, Europe, New York. So, you know, that results in kind of a top end price of these luxury condos there that are branded. Like they have one that was the Bentley Tower, or they have the Porsche Tower, or they brand them with specific kind of brands, but they're able to achieve just insane prices because they're attracting a global audience. Once you start to kind of say, look, like, we don't really want you here. Like, hey, we don't want you to, like, you need to rent this out, you, like all that stuff. I think the global capital just says, look, like, this is just not a market we want to invest in. And I think that's really the function of that. So downtown Vancouver, it could really fluctuate depending on what the regulations are around real estate.
So if all things considered or all things remaining the same, then the prices make sense right now in your mind? Like with all the layers upon layers of regulatory.
Yeah, to some degree, for sure. I mean, I do think, you know, over the past couple of years, I think prices were out of whack. I think prices in downtown Vancouver were undervalued for sure. But I don't know if you've been kind of checking some of the resale listings. I do have seen some prices go up in downtown and west side of Vancouver to the extent I'm like, okay, it's more in line of where they should be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think right around 2021, 2022 is, you're like, wow, like this is cheap, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, hey, that was a fruitful, we'll leave that one there. That was a good answer. I like that.
Nice.
What's the most expensive mistake you've made and what did it teach you?
From a real estate perspective, the most expensive mistake was a condo purchase in Calgary. So this was a new purchase. I don't know the exact year. It was like 2017. And the thought process behind it was, bought a brand new 2-bedroom condo, beautiful view, downtown Calgary, located in Mission, which I would say is like the Kitsilano of Calgary. And the price at the time was $450,000 for a 930 square foot unit, brand new, 2 parking stalls as well. And the thought process was, well, you know, Kitsilano, you know, a brand new unit, a similar unit, similar quality would be probably like 1 to 1.1 at the time. So, yeah. You know, like this is like a third the price of a Vancouver unit. So like naturally this makes sense. You know, I got to a point where, you know, I just decided there was other opportunities, and I, you know, the hassle of, you know, getting a property manager, ended up selling it for, I think it was a 25K loss. So the buyers ended up buying it for me for, you know, 415, 420, that kind of thing. And, you know, I think now the price is probably higher. Maybe it's 500, maybe it's 600, maybe it's higher. But ultimately the lesson learned on that is things take time. Just because you have a vision doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. It might happen in 10 to 20 years and not next year. So that would probably be my biggest real estate mistake. But I mean, fortunately in Vancouver, you know, for real estate investment decisions, I've been pretty fortunate. I don't have any others.
East Van Deals. I like it. Okay. Last but not least, John, and thank you so much for your time. This has been a fantastic conversation. If you had to start your career over in a completely different industry, what would you choose?
Probably sports somehow.
I've recently come back to thinking the same. I don't know why it took me. I'm 45. I realized I should have gotten to sports.
You know what? I mean, for me, it's kind of like, you know, when I was a kid, you'd play sports and you kind of take it for granted. Like, not only were you having fun, you're, you know, working with teammates, you had a common objective, you're trying to do all these things, but then you're like, oh, wow, like I'm also fit and have a healthy lifestyle. Like, you know, you'd play basketball and then have a liter Slurpee. So, you know, that kind of thing. But now as you get older, you know, I'm like, well, in your spare time, like you got a family, you got kids to take care of. But then you're like, okay, can I fit in 30, 40 minutes for a quick workout? How do I get this in? Because I need to keep up with this, that sort of thing. So, you know, if there's any way that I could merge the like health and wellness aspects into like passion and that sort of thing, I think that probably would be it. That'd be like my nirvana.
Yeah. You know what? I feel like I was thinking of it in two ways. One is the business aspect is really fascinating. I don't know enough about it. But the other side is this health and wellness is, in my mind, whether it's, you know, from the kind of gym you visit daily or weekly to, you know, any sporting activity I'm involved in, people are just happy. They're just happier. Like when yeah. they're there, when they're, the environment's always positive. It's like, I should be in these environments more often. Yeah. But okay. But the business side is, something that I've been kind of more and more getting interested in just from just observing and thinking, I would have loved to, love to be involved somehow.
Oh, totally. Well, even at the top of sports is pretty cutthroat, right? So for example, if you're following, there was a big NBA trade, Lakers and the Mavericks for Luka Doncic and, Antonio Davis. And it was a very shocking trade, especially because Luka, apparently he bought a $15 million house not that long ago in Dallas, thinking like, this is where I'm going to
live forever.
Yeah. And now I don't know what's going to happen to that home. Maybe he's going to visit it. Maybe he's going to put it on the market for a lot. I have no idea. But like, that's real life, right? You know, you drop 15 mil on a house and you get traded the next day. So,
yeah. Well, fantastic. John, how can people find out more about what you're up to and more about Zonda Urban? And if they're interested in advisory services or getting access to the data, what's best?
Totally. So in Canada, we have a Zonda Urban handle, zondaurban.com. And then the US, we have zondahome.com. Get in touch with me, Jay Benest at zondahome.com, and reach out and we'll be happy to connect.
We'll have to have you back on as soon as you find the time. Thanks so much.
All right. Cheers, Matt. Appreciate it.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with John Benest, Vice President of Product Development over at Zonda Urban.
Oh, man, I really I regret missing that conversation with John, but I'm gonna go back and listen to it once this is out. I'm super excited to hear his thoughts and takes on the market.
He's such a force. The depth of the analysis is so great. He's such a great guy. It's funny, you know, a lot of the people, returning guests that we have on the show, every time they come back, and I would say this stands true for next week's guest, Justin Smith, as well. When they come back on the show, you're like, man, we got to talk to this guy more often. And I feel like that's John Benest in a nutshell. I'm like, man, can we get you back on once a month?
Yeah.
And,
He's in the data like Stephen King in The It when he was writing It. He's deep in the literature.
I was thinking about it. You know who it is? That's like a Dennis Miller reference, right?
Like being a super obscure reference.
Cujo. Yeah, like no one else will know anything about it yet. It's Doug Ford anyway.
I should go back and I never found Dennis Miller that funny, but
he's very funny. The other thing is apparently Cujo is, and I don't think I ever read Cujo, but
I did.
It's an extended metaphor about alcoholism, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, that I didn't know.
Yeah. Some people are arguing anyway. But yeah, what else do we have?
Well, we haven't covered. You want to get into some D.H. Lawrence before we wrap this up here or what? Okay. Well, what else have we got, Matt? We got, of course, our site and everything's going on at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
That's right. VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over there for all things real estate related, including things like the Livewire. This is our weekly mailer where you get VIP access to pre-sales, stats every month, different types of stats like sales ratios where you can dig into price bands, neighborhoods, really get granular on what's selling and what's not. Of course, we also have tried and true private client services as well.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using private client services, you are standing still where the rest of us power walk by. You get days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. What a time to be monitoring the market. There are certain markets that don't have a lot of inventory where stuff's turning over very quickly, especially good product. there are multiples on stuff. I feel like the spring market has shown up in certain sub markets, but then of course there's stuff hanging around as well. So what a time to watch.
Absolutely. It's an interesting time to be monitoring the market.
Yeah, Matt, how can people get in touch with you?
Try me at any time, 778-847-2854 or matt@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
And of course, we also have that Kokomo line, info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com.
Well, have a great week. And we're back here next week with Justin Smith, founder of Hawkeye Wealth. Talk about forces.
Another great conversation. That was a great one. We've already recorded that one, so I can say with 100% certainty. Great episode.
Well, have a great week.
Take care.
2000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.